Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to season two of Experience Focused Leaders. I am delighted to introduce you to Shane Newman, serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, real estate developer. A story about Shane is that after dropping out from NYU Medical School, he built a venture, Junebug, in the nightlife digital events powerhouse, and then took some of the lessons from that, wrote a book called Nightlife Lessons, but more interestingly, started his second business, which he founded and exited, Easy Texting, the largest business SMS SaaS platform in the US. And now Shane is a prolific backer of startups, runs real estate portfolio, including Santa Monica Pier. And I am delighted to have you on the pod. Shane, welcome.
Well, Alex, thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here as well.
All right, so let's talk about the question that probably doesn't come up on a typical businessy podcast, which is the New York nightlife scene.
Yeah.
And why did you decide that you could build a mega business there?
It was accidental, just to be honest. I never thought that I would go from medical school into, you know, an industry like the nightlife business. Just to be clear,
sorry to interrupt, yes. But I hear, you know, doctors have a high addiction to alcoholism and other issues. Was there something that was vibing already or not?
No, actually, part of the reason why we were successful is that we didn't really even party. I mean, I barely drank, but, you know, we did something different. We built tech for the nightlife industry in general. So a lot of nightclubs, bars, event spaces used our tech. And we, you know, eventually built, you know, we built an operating system for them, which included like a marketing stack, POS. It also we did ticketing, which, you know, we were really one of the first ones to do that. And how I got into that is a little bit of a convoluted story, but I had a startup that my roommate from when I was in medical school, he was working at Goldman, and he wasn't going to NYU Med like I was, but he was a friend of mine from a long time ago. He convinced me to drop out and during the dot-com boom, do a startup, and he found, you know, investors that were dumb enough to give 22-year-olds millions of dollars to try a startup, which we did for about 2 years. And we went down with the dot-com bust as well.
So that was before med school?
That was about a year into med school. I dropped out.
A year into med school.
My roommate convinced me. We did a startup during, you know, the 1999 dot-com boom. About 2 years later, dot-com bust. And basically, I moved in with my girlfriend at the time, who was going to FIT. And she worked at some of these nightclubs on the side on the weekends to make some money. And I would go to pick her up when she got paid at the end of the night. And I just kind of was looking around and I saw everything was being done backwards, like pen and paper, you know, this 2000, 2001 time. And so, I said, well, this doesn't look real. So I like a real good solution. So I went back to her dorm room and I started programming. I had a degree in computer science, actually. I went to med school, but I studied computer science. And the rest was history from there. We made the software and then sold it in to a few nightclubs. And then over the next decade, we became really the incumbent in that field. There was nobody really going after that niche. And it turned into a really big business. And then the subsequent business, Easy Texting, came out of the need for sending text messages to patrons. And this is like 2005 because the efficacy of email, we were using email marketing, was really deteriorating because, at that time, basically Constant Contact and MailChimp and everybody, the DJ had one, the club had one, the
So email
promoter had
marketing
one.
wasn't working, SMS started to work, and you saw that there was no scalable way to deliver SMS marketing, and you built a business.
No one was doing it actually. You could Google it and you there was like n I mean, as far as I understand it, and maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, for years it was like shooting fish in a barrel for us because there was no solution. I mean, this is years before Twilio existed. It's 2005. And so it wasn't as clear, text messages go through the phone systems and not through the internet. So it's a different situation. And when we first introduced it, it was part of Junebug. And, I got like, I don't know, 100 calls right after we sent the first text message asking me how I did that, right? And
Because
the light bulb.
it was still cool. Yeah, and even like 2000, I'm kind of remembering Nightlife Live circa 2005, 8, 9. Like it was still pretty new to
Well,
get
2000,
text.
2000, yeah, 2005 was like the intro of the BlackBerry. So like as a practical matter, it wasn't really convenient to text through a touchpad, right? And so, the BlackBerry kind of opened that space up. I had a BlackBerry at that time, and no, really nobody was doing it, except for like in Europe. Some places in Europe were doing it.
In London, like I remember in London, there was more going on. So back to those of us that would have relived the glory of the nightlife scene, right? So what was different about it? Now that you've been involved in many other businesses, you've sold it obviously outside of the night experience economy. What did you do? You obviously didn't drink, so you didn't have like some secret, secret, I'd drink you under the table and close this deal recipe. So was it any regular business, or like, tell us more about that experience.
I think to a degree it was like any other regular business, except we were just kind of we looked at a niche and nobody else was looking at. It was also early, so there wasn't really a lot of competition. As a practical matter, in 2000, 2001, barely most places didn't even have a website. So a lot of the tools that you take for granted right now, like MailChimp, like Facebook wasn't even around, website like Wix or Squarespace or these types of things, none of these things existed,
So
right?
you gave a full stack, and so you gave a full stack. So kind of like OpenTable meets Eventbrite. Like that's kind of how I'm thinking about this. Is it like
Correct.
it?
There was no Eventbrite. So when we introduced ticketing, that was a really novel thing. And so I think for us, it was, the value proposition of abstracting that away for who are actually really early adopters, if you think about it. They're really everybody in that business, they're really trying to maximize their profits as soon as possible. So they're willing to try anything that makes sense. And they really need to come to terms on who their patrons are. So, and who their, patrons are tend to skew younger. And so you need to speak to them on their level, right? So People wanted to buy tickets online. People wanted to get invites via email. They wanted to see what's going on through a website. Those types of things. So,
And
I don't.
are the owners at that time in New York, is this like some stereotype of,
Yeah, literally. So,
mafia related, like something like
no,
all
no,
cash, or
no.
is it like a
Well,
clean, fun
yes,
business?
that's absolutely true. So, first of all, it started in New York, but we became, national over the 10 years. But New York is like the heart of where everything starts, essentially. I think it's still true for the nightlife business. It's definitely the avant-garde. Essentially, yeah, I mean, in the beginning, I was willing to do what other people weren't. I was willing to go and meet with these owners and managers and stuff on their terms. Like they could meet me at 3 in the morning, right? And so that's what I had to do. I had to meet them and do meetings at 3 in the morning. And a lot of times I may have to wait an hour because all of a sudden it got crowded, and or they had an employee problem and I'm waiting till like 4 in the morning. Some of them wanted to pay us in cash, so I had to go and pick up cash. I mean, in the beginning, I did what I needed to do to make the business successful, and that meant doing a lot of things I didn't want to do, right? Didn't want to do, but it was a bridge to get where we could then kind of set the terms for everything, right? Once you become the incumbent, everybody kind of comes to you and you become the de facto thing that everybody uses. So, no more paying us cash. You have to pay with credit card up front, like all these other things that came later. But I think, in the beginning, you have to be as flexible as possible and be willing to do what other people are not willing to do.
And at what point did you start feeling more confident? Was it that you just basically had more demand that you could cover? Is it you just
No,
felt like
I think when
efficiencies
we
weren't there?
started, no, once we started, we were like closing, at some point we started closing big corporate accounts because, like we would get like Johnny Walker or Mercedes that would want to kind of go into events and do sampling because this is like a real, elusive demographic for them, young urban professionals with a lot of disposable income. How do you reach them? We were really the only database that had that. We started doing other things that people didn't understand. Like we would go and take pictures at all the nightclubs and then post them the next day. Again, pre-camera phone era, pre-MySpace, Facebook era. Now, like no one will do that because everybody has a camera phone. And then we would give out cards to go on the website and see. And then when you would want to see your picture, you'd have to give us your data, right?
Oh, I
And we
must have
understand.
done that. I must be in your list somewhere that I'm
Absolutely.
sold
That
somewhere.
list is like long gone, my friend. I don't know where it is. Anyway, so I think once we started really getting bigger accounts, enterprise accounts, I think it really legitimized us and people really started looking at us in a different way. And then, what also transpired is that because we were in the ticketing business early, EDM started to really take off. And venues went from selling just, thousands of tickets to hundreds of thousands of tickets. And that turned into millions of tickets for us a year. And then, if you just do the math, we were getting, $3 convenience fee per ticket, that we would charge people. You sell 5, 10 million tickets. It's a lot of money, right? It's a lot of money. It's like thin air money, essentially, for selling a digital ticket. And so anyway, that was I think the two turning points were when we got really enterprise big name customers and clients, and we could, kind of flex that muscle. And then being, starting to sell a lot of tickets. And
The
then we
tickets,
had the we that also turned into an inflection point of our database. And we had the largest database of people who would go out, you know, buy tickets, buy tables, you know, go, you know,
yeah,
do
the
all
moment
these things.
You know
that,
somebody who's willing to buy a table, right? Like that sort of is, if you could identify that person, you obviously know somebody who has a lot of disposable income.
Correct.
And it's not at all price conscious, right? And so
we could tell exactly who they were, where they were, how much they spent. There was like a lot of data. We started doing really advanced things, like with ticket sales. We could actually figure out demand generation and velocity of ticket sales, and dynamically price the tickets. You know, you're talking about like 2008, right? Like that was really advanced for that time. Nobody was
you could
really
have built
thinking
some
about
dating apps off of the back of that data, I would imagine as well.
People call that artificial intelligence or data science now. You know, but it existed. It just didn't exist as, like, let's say, as easily, right? Easily
yes. Yeah,
understood.
You had to do. So like, take a step to like, for an audience that joins this podcast, they care about experiences, right? They whether it's a digital experience, and we've talked about buying a ticket to go to Night Show, fitting the demographic, fitting the change. So it feels like some nightclub owners don't have to be young, right? Like they could be a different demographic than their customers.
Yes.
So you basically had a challenge. They had a challenge, and you came in and fixed the need in terms of digital experience, creating a toolkit for them.
It was even like an edu. It was more than that. We had to educate them on it,
you
right?
had to educate,
So,
right?
yeah, there was no market on that, right? Initially, but I think, you know, it was definitely a lot of teaching people how to do things or what to do initially. And then once, you know, once like 10 places, like the top 10 places do something, the rest is just everybody copies, right?
Right.
So that was the key, was getting, you know, maybe the top 10 venues to implement this in the right way. And then once they did, it was just kind of much more easier to sell it into other places, because first of all, it's social proof. Like if the best nightclubs are doing it, then I should be doing it too. And second, it's like, oh, I got that email. I viscerally understand the experience once that happens, right? So you know, I think even if you look at things like Constant Contact and MailChimp, you know, initially when they started, it was a lot of educating the customer.
Yeah, I hear you. Even like, and when you're selling SaaS, and I'm assuming you move towards SaaS eventually for some of this.
We were SaaS. We had a hybrid model, so it was like it was SaaS, and then we had you know, we had an ad model too for other people, you know, for like
the promos
Mercedes
and the
those.
Ticketing model. Yeah. But when you're generally selling SaaS circa 2005, and I was at Salesforce, you know, and SuccessFactors at that era, you probably had more job educating people about the model and the technology as much as about the applications, right? Because people just weren't as familiar with. And that's something that I think people underestimate right now. But I remember I literally had like enabled our whole sales team, and I had like five set of differentiators that were pure tech and like why SaaS and other subscriptions matter, and then another five actually on the product, because that was not an obvious one. And I think in your industry it must have been even more of a challenge than inside typical corporates.
It definitely was. You know, what was actually even more interesting is that I actually was pretty prepared for that because of the failure of my previous company. So we were actually a SaaS company in 1999. We were trying to make basically Microsoft 365, but we did it through Citrix because there were no like web in 1999. There were no web-based apps, right? Like, so there were only Windows-based apps. But what you could do is you could, you know, kind of have like an icon in a web browser. You click Microsoft Word, and it opens a Citrix session on a server, and that Microsoft Word is really running on a server somewhere, and the internet is like one big keyboard, monitor, and mouse wire, right? And so you get the latest version of
So
Word,
you
you can
created
see.
the Word web docs, like Google Docs type of version back in the 90s.
No,
It
it was actual Word running on
was actual
Windows,
running
but
Word, yeah. But through the virtualization, yeah.
correct. It was a virtual, it was
Yeah.
exactly a virtualization. It was like a,
Yeah.
a virtual session, right? And so they didn't even have the word SaaS. They called it ASP, which is
Yeah,
Application Service
exactly.
Provider.
Yeah.
Like we would save your files in the cloud, but there was no word for cloud. And we had an app store because you could choose which apps or users could have access to, like Word, QuickBooks, whatever it was. But none of those words existed, right?
Yeah.
And so, and the ultimate failure happened not because, not really because of the dot-com bust. I mean, yeah, funding dried up, but we were just too early. Like people were not ready to pay for, whatever, $30 a month per user for Word, right? They were used
Yeah.
to installing it on their computer and then every
Yeah.
couple of years buying an upgrade.
But it's funny, you bring up this memory that I think people underestimate. We call everything cloud right now, but it was like ASP, then it was on demand, then it was SaaS, now it's cloud. Same thing, more or less, right? Like I would say ASP
I mean,
probably
it's
was
exactly
not
the same thing.
multi-tenant, most of the time. So like it was probably a little bit more old school, but
Yes.
fundamentally the same
Well, it's the
concept. It
same thing
just
with
goes
AI
rebranded.
now. They call like chatbots AI agents now, right? It's the same thing. I mean,
Absolutely.
it's just like a more advanced form of the same thing.
I'm curious, like actually, like jumping a little bit ahead. So you've had this great set of lessons, right? Like where lesson one led you to success in the second business. Second business, you discovered that, hey, this texting thing is a real deal. There's an opportunity. And then you went out of the nightlife experience industry and built as leading SaaS business for SMS. How when you look at your new ventures now and as an investor, are you looking for serial entrepreneurs that kind of have gone through a similar journey and like had like problems and then uncovered these
Yeah.
problems? Are you looking for people, guide me a little bit of how that informs your current strategy?
Yeah, I mean that would be ideal, but as a practical matter, multi-exited founders typically raise at higher valuations. And so, they can demand more from and investors, and typically they get funded right away. If you've built two or more or even one company and had an exit and had a respectable exit, obviously
It's
as an
harder to
investor,
discover you. It's harder to discover Shane, than it would be to go to Sequoia or Accel and just
yeah,
get a big check,
you could go to one of those bigger ones. It's actually funny though, as a practical matter, I think that a lot of founders these days are trying to avoid those bigger VCs for the most part, or doing a hybrid of VCs and family offices because they see the value the family offices bring. And as a practical matter, unlike VCs, we're not as onerous on them. We're not like constantly asking them for reporting or telling them how they should run their business or those types of things. And really, as an investor, like I don't really want to do that. Like if I have to tell you what to do, then like I'm not investing in you, because like that's not the point of investing. The point of investing is backing people who you think are smarter than you and can do what you can't do, right? In my opinion. And honestly, like maybe I know some things, right? But things change and the world changes, and maybe something that I experienced 5 years ago is not true anymore. And I may skew you as a founder into doing something wrong, that would be that I think is right but is actually wrong. So as a practical matter, I just really want someone who has the ability, I think, to deal with problems head on and to solve them, right? Without, if they ask me for help, I'm going to obviously give them help. But I don't want that to be the de facto mode of things, right? So, yeah, obviously, if you've done it before, the I'd love to, invest in you because, the likelihood of you winning again is high. But that's not exclusive to me. I think, spending a lot of time with founders is important. And, just cliche, but 90% of it is who you're investing in, not what they're doing. And so you have to be good at understanding who you're investing in.
So how do you do that, right? Like, how do you get to the gut of the person you're investing in? When we chatted last time, we had some very interesting stories about immigrants, right? The trials of like some challenges that you've overcome, whether it's in your early life, family life. Where do you pinpoint toward that grit and determination and persistence to chew through glass or whatever it takes to get that business to
I'll
return your
give you an
money.
ex listen, it depends honestly if I'm doing if I'm doing a significant investment, I'm going to obviously spend more time. If I'm doing a less significant investment, I'm going to spend less time. And it's like, you can't like, you can't, you know, there's only a finite amount of time that you have, right? But when I'm doing more significant investments, I actually, like, I'll give you like an example. I invested in a company called Flex Storage that does like kind of, storage units that they bring to you, and then you put your stuff in it, and either kind of like pods, but it's a tech enabled one. And I found, and they either take it away for you or they leave it on your property for you. And basically, you don't have to go to self storage anymore. You can they can bring it to you. And I spent a week at their office, literally, and I got on the truck and I delivered, a whole day's worth of trailers, and I got to meet who the customers are. I got to see how the founder talks on the phone. I got to see how he or she interacts with their team. And when you do that, there's no faking that. Like, there's no way to fake. Like, I mean, I guess if someone wants to create an elaborate fake, they could, but as it's the probability of that is low. But like, I literally do that.
But
If I'm in
you
it.
also probably have a horse sense now, right? Like what's real and what's fake, right? Having done
So
this before,
yeah,
right?
I mean, to get to the point of me deciding to go there for a week, obviously I have to, I'm not, that wasn't my first intuition. I met with the person, I spoke to them several times, and that kind of thing. But, in that respect, I knew the guy had been in the army for like a decade, right? And that, and had logistics thing and experience, and five of the guys that are working with him were under him, and he was the captain. So like, some things just make common sense.
Let's reverse the gears. Like if let's say you there's a founder or aspiring founder listening to this, and they want to kick the tire on Shane and your family office, right? And like what do people do? What do you find that impresses you when they're doing due diligence on you? Let's say it's a big enough investment where it matters, right? It's not like a tiny check. Because I think the this is another important part of equation. Like a lot of people are in a fortunate position where capital is not the real constraints. It's either if this capital is easy and friendly, or it's maybe not significant in volume, but it's high value and signaling and introductions and whatever else that's needed, not for day-to-day execution, but some kind of a lever that helps entrepreneur get an edge. And that's how I think about capital. Is it going to get me an edge? If I don't need tons of it, right? And so the question is for you, Like if you were reverse selling yourself, right? What's the value add for Shane or broader the family office as an asset class? You started covering that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is when you get an investor like me, it's my money. So I'm going to really give a shit, to tell you the truth. So like, you know, unlike a VC who goes and raises money from a lot of people and you're maybe dealing with like an account rep that gets paid, I don't know, $100, $150,000 a year and, you know, works for a partner who raised money from institutional capital that doesn't really care. You know, you're one of 1,000 companies that they invested in. And if you go broke, it doesn't really matter. I think, you know, it makes a big difference.
So portfolio for you is more concentrated on these investments. And so, and also it's, you know, touches your financial returns very directly. So you give a shit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so what also tends to happen is when a family office finds a good investment, they tend to share it with other family offices. And most family offices are run by, you know, entrepreneurs who've had exits. I mean, they're not like dynastic, you know, where, I mean, some are, but like, I would say in this day and age, a lot of them are run by other entrepreneurs that have had exits and they have connections and they have resources and stuff that are valuable and that can either be potential customers for you, can be other investors for you, can be mentors for you and those types of things. So, and also, by the way, there what's interesting about family offices is that they can move a lot faster than a VC can in most cases. You know, they have latitude, right? I mean, and they can do things that are, you know, like I've done a range of investments from like med tech to self storage to, you know, robotics to CPG. You know, it all, you know, it's all fair game. There's no mandate. I don't have investors that I said that this is all I'm going to invest in, right?
So actually that's very interesting because I was intrigued by your both the barbell strategy. Maybe you could kind of cover that in a few words, and also the range of investments, and particularly the mix of real estate portfolio like Santa Monica Pier, and then doing super deep tech stuff. Right? Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about that, and maybe how do you bring it all together?
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate in that, you know, I have a background in tech, so I can, let's say, assess and diligence tech pretty well. You know, I built what I didn't say is, you know, Junebug and EasyTexting were profitable businesses because they were bootstrapped. And so I had a lot of real estate investment experience, let's say, over the last 20 years, because I did come from an immigrant family who always told me to reinvest my money into real estate and not particularly the stock market, although maybe I should have done the stock market. But anyway,
you pursued the American dream of real estate version.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a lot of experience with it, and I had been investing in it for a while. But really, getting back to the barbell strategy, the last, let's say, 4 or 5 years, I've been kind of looking at things through the lens of who are the leaders in deep tech, let's say like AI, quantum, robotics, those types of things, right? Because I think that's, I mean, I'm not saying anything that people don't know, but that's definitely the future, right? And I'm relatively young, so I think that, you know, for me to think 20 years out is still okay for me. And then I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to invest in businesses or assets that I don't think can really be disrupted by deep tech, right? Mm. Or let's just say I don't have a good enough imagination to to think about the ways in which they could be disrupted. And so when you're talking about the Santa Monica Pier, it's a business. It's kind of like Coney Island, right? It has a games, food and beverage, it has rides. It's been around for 30 years. It's either number one or two tourist destination in Los Angeles. And so unless tourism somehow gets disrupted by AI, which is hard to imagine how that would happen, unless we go into like a virtual world or something, which could happen. It's in the realm of possibilities, but I think it's a low probability event. People are going to still want to like go and experience these things and take their kids and do that. So, and they want to eat, right? And like have fun. And so, and they want to be in California,
If you're in California, you will get thirsty. It's hot.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the weather's good. People will, it's the United States. And so, yeah, maybe, right now it's had some short-term problems, with the fires and stuff like that. But as a practical matter, so when I'm looking at that, and again, it may just be my short-sightedness of my imagination. I can't really think of a way that I think that in 20 years from now, it's not going to be here. Right.
And the same thing,
And
it sounds like the storage investment, like, are
exactly
people going to
like
be
the,
buying crap? Yes. Are people going to be lazy? Yes. So if you
yes.
take and control the crap in a convenient way, is there value there? Yes. Right. Like that sort of sounds like
Absolutely.
that's
Like,
the thesis, right? Like, by the way,
yes.
a funny story. I when I was moving from San Francisco to London to grow SuccessFactors business, I had this many years of earned library of books, and I was just like so proud of it. It was my like the most valuable thing, and I kind of decided to play it cheap and just give it to a family member in storage, and they kind of misplaced it, dislocated it, and I of all my possessions, right, like this is still kind of a little nuts. Oh, I'm so bummed. They eventually got donated, so I feel like that was good. But like it was still like this thing that's like, oh, this is a personal thing, right? So you're saying like, hey, we reduce the risk and make it easy for you not to lose something that happened what you
Well, the self-storage business is a huge business. Just the self-storage guys themselves, if you go and look at Public Storage or Extra Space Storage, they're publicly traded companies, they're REITs, and they I mean they command a big premium because as what you just said, people may leave their homes and downgrade to a cheaper place, but they will never give up their like memorabilia. It could be in storage for like 30 years, and they just don't want to get rid of their shit. And so that like they may have never even seen it in 30 years, but they
Well, that's
just
like
never.
basic loss aversion is working for this business, right? Like psychology
Absolutely.
101, right? You don't want to lose your stuff, right? And then there's so much crap that it's so hard to sift through it. So you just kind of solve it with convenience, which is what you're doing. I love it.
So we're either doing that or doing the on the opposite spectrum of things. And then anything in the middle where I can't really determine whether or not it's going to be disrupted or is going to be around, I'm just staying away from, because I'm not smart enough to figure it out, right? And I'd rather and there's so many bets to be made. I don't have to take those bets, right?
So,
You win all the bets you don't take, pretty much.
how now that you're out of New York, right? You live in
In
South
Miami, yeah.
Florida, Miami area. How has that move influenced your either decisions about investing or generally kind of worldview? Because I think a lot of people are. We're excited about Miami at some point coming there. Certainly, New York is still continuing, but like San Francisco, it feels like a bunch of people left San Fran, moved to Miami, and then some are coming back, some are still fans. So you've seen this
Yeah.
this trajectory. Tell me a little bit. You're investing in super cool things from Miami. So, like, what is that location influence your decision process on investments?
So I think that if you're talking about real estate and traditional businesses, I think Miami is, just South Florida, Florida in general, Texas, these are they're great places still, and there are a lot of smart people doing really smart things here. And it's a great market, it's a friendly market, it's a growing market. And so if you're going in that direction, I would highly suggest it. As a practical matter, I think that if you're gonna go into tech or cutting edge types of things, Miami has proven itself that it can't sustain that. The talent is not, I'm just talking about South Florida in general. And obviously this is a generalization, right? There are really successful tech companies here, but I'm just talking about, like, in general, what I'm seeing. In general, I see that, SF, New York, LA is where all the founders are eventually going. There were a bunch that were here in Miami, especially crypto, but they're, the talent just was not here, right? The talent was missing. And so there's
Or
not this,
distracted,
like,
you would you say?
It's so I think the talent, yes, they're distracted in that the people who moved here already have money, or like they had an exit or something like that, or they're the general partners of these funds, right? That have a lot of money. And so, and they can afford, places here and to stay here, even though their industry isn't here, right? And so you'll get a lot of that, but you don't get the, what you need in a startup, which is young, hungry, not even just young, but hungry, entrepreneurs that are willing to do,
Whatever it takes.
24th.
Show up at 3 a.m. and try to close the deal with cash and then try to do that deposit at a bank. That sort of
Absolutely.
mindset, right? Like Shane circa early 2000s.
Yes. I mean, literally, we would go, like, to Wells Fargo and, like, the next morning and deposit the cash, right? So I don't think that's here. Although, if you can pull it off here, you might do very well, because again, those people who are
There's
funding
a
you
lot
are
of high net
here.
worth.
Yeah. So it's worth coming here at least to look for people that are investors. But I can tell you that, also work from home is dead pretty much in the startup ecosystem. I think that everybody kind of came to the realization, if you want to build and scale a business, the magic happens in person. There's been a definite vibe shift on that, on that front. So, if you're going to do that, you might as well go where all the other,
So if you want warm weather, stick to South Bay or LA. Not Miami is sort of for very specific businesses may work, but not as a center of gravity. Israel is another great location
Absolutely.
for
Very,
those
very innovative.
that are into warm weather. Now, if we back to warm weather climate. So like, let's talk a little bit more about Santa Monica Pier, right? Because the investment size that you made there is quite sizable, if I recall our conversation, right?
Yeah,
So
it was a I mean, it's a iconic place, so it's a large investment.
how did you think about that as kind of like why put so much bets in that, right? Like, so I get the like we get the barbell strategy, but the actual like allocation
So
component.
I think of something like the Santa Monica Pier as a forever asset. Imagine if someone came to you and said, "Oh, look, you can buy, the operation. You can't buy it. You can't. We can't actually buy the Santa Monica Pier, right? It's owned by the city of Santa Monica, but we have a ground lease there for a long period of time, and there's an operations there. There's, it's a business, right?
Right.
And so it's a business and a tourist destination. And so as a practical matter, if someone told you, look, you can have the business surrounding the Statue of Liberty, like, and you can buy it, would you buy it? Absolutely, you'd buy it, because, you know, for the next 100 years, you're going to make money, right?
So basically, and diamonds, so, it's kind of a De Beers, diamonds are forever strategy. This is a diamond.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be high-tech diamond, right? Like, it's just flagship.
Yes,
flagship experience,
it's,
right?
It's, and, yeah, it's cash flowing. It's been cash flowing. You know, it has a 30-year history that you can look back on, and so it's iconic. I mean, everybody that I tell that, you know, every, like, there hasn't been one person that I've said, oh, that doesn't know that Ferris wheel, right? It's
right.
It's the eighth most Instagram place on earth, actually. Just to be,
and
you
the
know,
Hollywood, the Hollywood being there, and like all the films that are taking place in LA, around LA, kind of like helps you make sure this will always stay there. Unless Hollywood gets displaced, right, it will always be the location. Is that kind of another way of thinking of why it's so popular?
No, I just think that, you know, New York, LA, Miami are like the three biggest cities in New York, right? I mean, in America. And a lot of these things are mostly tourist, you know, like it's like 70% tourist driven. And so it's really a bet on whether or not LA will continue to be a tourist destination in America. And if you believe that, and you believe that in the next, you know, for the next 30 to 50 years, if that's the case, then, you know, this is a good bet. And so, as a practical matter, I don't get opportunities like this very often. And when you see something like this, those are the times I think that you take outsized bets, when you see something like that.
So to what degree you're, you know, this is back to experience and the kind of, maybe let's talk a bit more about how do you create this experience economy, right? Like, so we just described what it is, like, so going to Santa Monica Pier is an experience, you're participating in that. How are you thinking about what else can we do to create, you know, modern, you know, memories that are fostered through digital experiences, through physical experiences? Are you spending cycles on that given your investments, or is this just something that you delegate to the operating company?
My partner operates it. I'm not, he's really the general partner. So like, I'm not really operating. I don't have the infrastructure for that. And I actually quite often I do that. I, you know, either invest with or JV with, or, you know, that kind of thing of operators that, and general partners that I know are very good. And that way, I can spend my time doing more of the stuff I like to do instead of like actually operating
you
the
get
place.
To live in Miami and
yes.
You know, not travel and do quality control in Santa Monica Pier,
the
way
this,
Disney does.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but yeah, I mean, look, there's definitely been, you know, we upgraded the F&B component recently. There's a place called, it's now called Snackville. So now there's like characters involved with it, kind of like you would do like a McDonald's, but like a healthier version, right? Yeah. And so those experiences matter. There are mascots now. You know, we've upgraded and expanded the amount of rides there are. We've definitely implemented technology so that people don't wait online as much. We got the first alcohol license that they've ever had in their history. So now you can kind of, you know, as a parent, you can have a glass of wine or a beer or whatever, you know, and enjoy yourself as well.
June Bug owner license, using supporting you guys in that?
No. June Bug was... I mean, I sold that business almost 20 years ago. So that's a long, that's like, it feels like a lifetime ago, honestly.
Yeah.
It feels
so,
like a
so
lifetime
you
basically, ago.
But to bring back to the topic, you are continuing to extend this platform as part, and that was part of the investment thesis, is that you will create
Yes, absolutely.
More modern, more kind of Universal Studios on a pier type of vibe, where it's something that becomes, more and more talked about, and you get more throughput, obviously, in terms of tourists and their experiences. It sounds like that was the approach.
Yes, absolutely. There was definitely a there's definitely like a business plan, let's just say, right? Other than just kind of purchasing it. So yeah, I mean, I think in that respect, there were a bunch of things that were pretty obvious that we could do to improve.
So as we wrap up, Shane, I'd like to try something new, but really relevant to our audience. So we care about creating great human experiences, be they in person, be they digital. So you've written a book about the nightlife experiences. You've obviously invested in amazing assets. You've run teams. So what are kind of couple examples of horrible experiences that you've went through, either kind of early in your life that helped you, that taught you a lesson of some kind? And then we'll come back on the finish on a more positive, like what are kind of lessons that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah. Actually, my book is full of horrible experiences of how I got screwed over, and you can from getting someone giving me their credit card that d ended up declining, and bounced checks, is it, I can, there's like almost too many of them for me to pick one. And I think what taught me the most about grit is actually going through litigation. And it sounds really weird, but in easy texting that happened. So my book is filled with all the different kinds of ways I got screwed over by people in that industry, and how you can avoid yourself. Avoid getting it screwed over, and how I use those lessons subsequently in either easy texting or as I'm investing. But
So
in easy
maybe
texting,
that's the secret advice for entrepreneurs. If you're worried that you're in an industry where you'll get screwed, Shane should be your investor. He's seen it all. He'll be the
I'm
he'll be the
almost like,
differentiated value.
I think it's almost, I think when you're young and sort of naive, it's an asset to you, because I don't know if I would have done the things that I'd done, what had I known what I had to go through to get through success, right? Like all the like pain and suffering and sleepless nights and I don't know, weeks on end of not sleeping and working, what if I knew, if someone told me beforehand that you would have to do all of these things, I'm not so sure I would done it.
So
It's like saying,
the
like,
sleepless night of the nightlife industry were not sleepless for the reason that people thought, right?
no, I was literally working all the time, and then like going to work, and we had, hundred some odd employees, like it was like with big offices and stuff. So, I in easy texting, I'll just, there's a long story, but I'll make it short. But there were some existential problems that we had, mainly getting sued for spam text messages, right? And so we didn't send us text spam text messages, but we had some bad actors that subverted our systems and sent out some black spam. And so we got sued alongside them. And the damages for these types of things are so large that they could literally bankrupt your company, especially if you're a young company, right? And when you get litigated against in federal court or something like that, just the legal expenses of defending yourself are huge. And so I made it through one litigation, but and it cost a lot of money, and I learned a lot about how the whole system works. And then I was like, if I have to go through this again, I'm not going to be able to survive. And so, if real, like in the real spirit of entrepreneurship, I was like, you know what? I'm going to proactively spend some money and see how I can prevent myself from being sued again. Because obviously, a lot of these class action lawyers, they get paid on contingency, and so they don't
They don't
really
have a
like,
they don't have a hard stop, right? Like
they don't really care. And so, I mean, I was like some guy with a SaaS company, and then the next thing I know, I'm, meeting with the FCC and DC and doing a petition to them to give us an exemption, right? And like, which would I have ever thought in my life that I would be sitting in front of the FCC asking for an exemption for text messaging providers from this rule? No, but eventually we got through it, and it really did prevent a lot of things from happening that could have really ruined our business
That's really
eventually.
interesting. So the medium innovation, the distribution innovation was also was the whole raison d'être for the business, but it also was the biggest risk factor and the
Absolutely.
biggest
Well,
thing that
anytime
screwed
you
you over.
innovate, that's how it goes, right? People find novel ways to screw you over.
Exactly. We haven't screwed anybody over on this one before. So moving over to the positive, right? Like what are And these could be things that you've done in running your company or creating kind of environments that just make the human spirit thrive. Because I think oftentimes we don't think, like I think Santa Monica Fair, I'm thinking like I'm thinking peers, or I'm thinking like children, memorable experiences. You're creating a
No,
memory, which is
I
priceless.
just
Like, tell me more about it. Like, what are you thinking about?
I actually my latest investment is a company called Endiatics, which is a robotic pill that you can swallow, and you get on Zoom like this with your doctor, and you drink a couple of glass of water, and the doctor controls the pill in your
Hold on,
stomach and
I'm
does
just
it.
gonna take it right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So
And does an upper
what's happening to
endoscopy for
me?
you.
Oh wow.
Absolutely. The,
Oh, it's
and,
working.
and so yeah, and they can
How
do
many
a
hours? I can send you back the analysis
No,
in the
it's real time. It's real time. It streams the video from inside your stomach and does an upper endoscopy for you. And as a practical matter, if you want to do an upper endoscopy right now, you have to go to the hospital, get sedated, but put to sleep, plus something like $15,000, and you need an anesthesiologist and a gastroenterologist and two nurses just to look into your stomach and see if there's anything wrong. This pill,
Anytime there's
can
an
do that for you.
anesthesiologist, that's already like a risk factor that this might backfire.
No, people, yeah, absolutely. People die from anesthesia all the time just to look into their stomach. Why? And they lose half a day of work to do that. And so, as a practical matter, the experience of having an upper endoscopy should be as simple as you taking a pill and being able to 10 minutes, the doctor take a look visually, make sure everything's okay. And then, if obviously something's not okay, then you can go into the doctor. But 70% of the 75 million of these performed a year globally are just screenings, just to look
Preventative
into your
screening,
stomach.
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Correct. And so why do you have to put someone to sleep to do that? And why does it have to cost so much money? And why do they have to? And a lot of people won't do it because they're scared. Me particularly, just on a personal note, I have a lot of personal connection to this because 35 years ago, my father passed of gastric cancer, mainly because he was too scared the year before to go and get a tube put down his throat. And just think about how many people that happens to. They're
Yeah.
just too scared to do the procedure because they don't want a tube stuck down their throat. And so, there should probably be 400 million of these done a year, but only 75 are done because it's too expensive or people are scared to do it. And so, from an experience standpoint, user experience
Yeah.
standpoint, imagine all you had to do was take a pill in the morning, 10 minutes, get on a Zoom with your doctor, and you can do this. And you can do this like on a yearly basis, and it could stop, a bunch of different issues that people suffer from.
This is so amazing. And first of all, thank you for sharing the personal story, because it actually means so much, right? That you could go now be in a position to rectify the pain for other families that you've gone through, I imagine, in a profound
Absolutely.
way. And
Absolutely.
shout out to you for finding that opportunity and doing it. That's
I literally
kind
found
of
it. I saw that they did a TED talk in April, and the guy swallowed it, and the other founder is the head of GI at Mayo Clinic in the United States. And they performed an upper endoscopy, and I literally went on LinkedIn the next day, called them, and I said, "Can I come to your offices?" And they're like, "Yeah, we're in Silicon Valley. Come." And I got on the plane, and I went, and we funded their entire round pretty much.
That's amazing. And I think it kind of goes back to the beginning of like, what are the most meaningful entrepreneurial adventures? That it's the ones where you've seen the pain firsthand. It's not where you kind of start with sort of like pseudo bullshit MBA approach, where you're like, I'm gonna screen through these 15 opportunities, and then no, you actually feel the pain, know it, maybe viscerally understand it, and I
I
could
mean,
just.
I get an endoscopy every year because of
Yep.
this, and I
So
literally
you knew
know
the
that.
pain, you know the pain, right? It's funny. I was talking to someone recently, and I was asking, well, like, how did you join SuccessFactors? I didn't fund it, but like, it was pretty early. How did you do it? How did you know that this is gonna work? I'm like, well, when we were refugees and got to the U.S., my mom got a job, like, and she got promoted, and she needed to do re employee performance reviews for her QA team that she was managing. And I was a high school, like barely like high school English kind of guy. And then she was like, I'm suffering in pain of writing these performance reviews. Can you help me? So I was writing these performance reviews for employees, for my mom. And I was like, this is such a pain, right? In a software world, kind of similar to your, what you've seen, the industry operating old school, right? The way we started Relatu, it's like we see these PDFs that have all these good ideas, just like this procedures, they're really helpful. They could save lives, but people don't want to engage with them, don't want to do it because it's painful, consumer experience, right? And so we're reducing friction for consuming what's good for people, right? And that's what you've done with this investment. So I love it. I think that supports a lot of the themes of bringing great human experiences means that we need to recognize our limitations, that we're a little bit, averse to loss, averse to trying new things, that we kind of have some laziness to us. So anything that removes friction is a win. And it sounds like that's some of the themes that underpin whether you're investing in storage or healthcare procedures that are saving lives, right? But through better user experience for the patient.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I think that's listen, if you can do, if you can invest and you can meet the mandate of your investment, obviously every investment is the point of it is to make money. But if you can do that and at the same time do something amazing and good that helps every, a lot of people, then why not? You should definitely, I mean, I always look for stuff like that, and I always look for stuff that I have personal experience with because I can make a better decision that way.
Shane, this has been so wonderful to connect and deep dive into this. If people want to find you and your investments or other areas, where can you be
Yeah,
found?
sure. I'm really active on LinkedIn, so if you just type in Shane Neiman, I'm there. And so I read all my messages there and pretty active there.
Shane Neiman, ladies and gentlemen, from creating memorable experiences in Santa Monica Pier to saving the lives of people who are hesitant to take the necessary medical procedures. Thank you very much. Great to have
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, S-H-E-V-L-E-N-K-O. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.